Hi, everyone. My name is Julia, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Julia.
And so we continue with our four part, unless we get fired, which is totally possible. A lot of folks weren't here the last couple weeks, but in the first week we went through the doctor's opinion and talked about diagnosis of the spiritual malady and what our real problem is. And last week, Jim especially went through the writings of Harry Thibault, who was Bill's psychiatrist and also an early friend to AA. And he talked a lot about surrender and about how critical that was in the process of getting and staying sober. One of the quotes that we have that'll take us right into this week is when he said, unfortunately, the ego will return, and he identifies the ego as the problem, right? Because we know for a lot of us that drinking was kind of our solution, right? And our problem was us. Unfortunately, he says, the ego will return unless the individual learns to accept a disciplined way of life, which means the tendency toward ego comeback is permanently checked. So what we're going to sort of talk about this week is, tonight, is how the process of surrender is a critical piece, but then how we have to find new footing somewhere else, and how we have to sort of build a new foundation, a God-centered consciousness. And this is like pretty widely agreed upon, even by one of the recurring motifs I think we've created, is like a lot of these people who were not alcoholics, the things that they observed. And I just love hearing what these doctors and various folks have to say. A lot of them are scientists, because they have sort of an unabashed, unchecked look. A wide eye on what it means to be an alcoholic. You know, these are people who've seen a lot of us. And so they can make these observations with a little bit of a sort of a neutral tone, you know. And I just love that. It's kind of harsh, right? Because a lot of this, you know, we hear from them what we're really like. So this is from a meta-analysis that was done. This is actually pretty recent, and you may have seen it. This article I'm pulling from is in the most recent Box 459, which I don't know if anybody gets that. It comes from GSO. It's a quarterly newsletter. If you're a GSR, you get it. Anyway.
It's really good.
Yeah. So this is...
What was the name of it?
The Box 459.
Oh, yeah. So
this is an interview that was done with these two scientists who did this meta-analysis on AA, and contrary to popular opinion and what we read about lately, that they actually found that it really works. So he talks about how it works. And this one scientist responds to the question. Another point in terms of the topic of how AA works is spirituality. AA is a spiritual program, of course, not a religious one. George Vallon, who's a psychoanalyst and research associate, has written that spirituality is based on our biology, whereas religion is based on our culture. Spirituality is part of our limbic system. We have the capacity for spiritual emotion. Religion is like the lyrics, and spirituality is the music. AA doesn't give you the lyrics. You can borrow some or write your own. AA opens the doorway through which people can walk and discover their spiritual lives. From a biological perspective, it is really important to have access to all these positive emotions that could be called spirituality. Gratitude is very important, as well as humility. These emotions activate a sense of awe, as Vallon says. It's worth remembering that with AA, that Catholics do it and Jews do it, Native Americans too. It is fast growing in Iran. And of course, atheists and agnostics. It is remarkably flexible spiritually. So we all talk a lot about the spiritual experience, but what I really love in this is that he talks about the embodiment of spirituality. And I think last week I touched a little bit upon my own experience with that, and how the process of surrender was one that that was embodied. It wasn't just a decision that my brain made. You know, it wasn't something where There were so many consequences, and so the rational choice was to stop drinking, because if that were the case, I would have done that many years before. And tried, and that never worked. But until I had that true visceral experience, one that was larger and sort of went around my stinking brain, that's the only chance I had of success. So that was kind of what we realized when we started talking about surrender and the next steps into our recovery. So what I experienced with my surrender was that was, as I said last week, like this integrative collapsing of steps 1, 2, and 3. It was like I did it all at once. Like I did that first thing. But I had nowhere to go from there. You know, I had to develop a new way of living. I had to move from that old one to a new one. And so the name of this talk that we're doing tonight is Coming Home. And how for me, the steps were that process that kind of carried me from the old place to a new one. Because while I had this momentary and very powerful experience, where am I going to go from there? You know, how am I going to integrate cognitively all this experience and, you know, of great moment, you know, this experience that I had? If I just quit what I'm doing and have this vague notion of God, you know, I'm gonna need a little more help than that. And the process of doing the steps for me was one, and it remains one every day, of continual little surrenders, and just as Thibaut talked about. And so I just was going through, into action and finding all these places where Bill and others, you know, Bill and the other editors, because he didn't talk about this. And I also spoke last week about what great lengths that I had gone to avoid discomfort. Discomfort, you know, if you're basically, in my mind, if you're comfortable, you're not growing. You know, you can be doing one thing or the other, but the only place of growth is really uncomfortable, and I did anything to avoid discomfort. So here he is, just at the beginning of Into Action, when he starts talking about the fifth step, which is not one of my most comfortable experiences. Trying to avoid this humbling experience, they have turned to easier methods. Almost invariably, they got drunk, talking about the fifth step. Having persevered with the rest of the program, they wondered why they fell. We think the reason is that they never completed their house cleaning. They took inventory all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. So here is like perfect example where Bill's saying, like, your thinking mind is just not enough. And I'm pulling in this fellow Emmett Fox that some of you guys may know about, and Jim's going to tell you more about him later, but I just love this quote. So just briefly, Emmett Fox is a contemporary of Bill's, and he'll tell you later, but a little bit of a tease on Emmett Fox. We make spiritual progress by putting God into every corner of our lives. Most people on the spiritual path are willing to give God a generous portion of their lives, but there is often one little corner where they do not wish the divine light to shine. So here we are, like, doing the fifth step. What's that one thing that we're not saying, right? Bluebeard, you remember, kept open house with the exception of one little room, and there he drew the line. His current wife, or any of the neighbors, could go all over the premises and welcome until they came to that one little room, the Bluebeard chamber, that was forbidden. Yet that one little locked-up room contained the tragedy of the house. The contents of the Bluebeard room need not be anything that we usually call horrible. There may just be selfishness, laziness, spiritual pride, or any of the other more respectable but very deadly sins. There may be an old grudge or bitter remorse. Open every door of your soul to God. Have no place where the light of his presence does not shine. So back to the big book. So just moving through it into action, and especially with the fifth step, the importance of honesty, of openness. Unwilling to be honest with these sympathetic men, we were honest with no one else. right? So here we go. We pocket our pride and go to it. So perfect case of surrender, right? We surrender our egos in order to go into this fifth step, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. And then we have the fifth step promises. Once we have taken this step, withholding nothing, we are delighted. We can look the world in the eye. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease. Our fears fall from us. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. So on and so on. We feel we are on the broad highway, walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. And then he takes us into, you know, the quick description of 6 and 7. And at this point, you know, after this surrender, what he's saying is like, we can look the world in the eye, because for me, it's sort of like our eyes open a little bit to who we are, right? So if we talk about coming home as the journey, we've said that the, you know, that priest we loved, who talked about alcohol separates us from God, self, the universe, and others. Mm. So part of this process of coming home is coming home to God, self, other, universe, and others. But we're not coming home to the, can't come home to that, that Ricky old home that that we came from. And it's funny, I was just thinking about this. I had a really good friend when I lived in San Francisco, and his job was seismic retrofit on old homes. So a lot of earthquakes, right, in San Francisco. And he worked on houses in Berkeley and Oakland where the foundations were, where the foundations were in danger of cracking should there be an earthquake. So they literally went in, jacked up houses, and cleaned out the old foundations and built entirely new ones. And so when we talk about coming home, this is the kind of coming home we're talking about. You know, we can't go into the old patterns, the old programs of happiness. Like, they're just not going to fly. And on we go through the steps, reminding ourselves that we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. We ask that we be given strength and direction to do the right thing. So this is where, you know, we're getting further into the steps. And he even says at one point about the fellow who's willing, who was afraid he might go to jail, you know, if he came clean on everything. And we have to even be willing to do that, you know. So, whizzing through here. So we get more into steps 8 and 9. And here we have more surrender. Hmm. We have giving up our old ideas of what we were really like. Sometimes we hear an alcoholic say that the only thing he needs to do is to keep sober. Right? So, I'm the nicest guy, Adrian Clark again, like, I'm the nicest guy you ever met, you know? So, like, that's a lot of nonsense, right? So as we start to open our eyes and see and look around us, we have to surrender this notion that it was just us, you know? We were the only ones who got damaged. And as we begin to move through this, you know, we're going to have to surrender more and more to actually look someone else in the eye and do our proper amends. We feel a man is unthinking when he says that sobriety is enough. And this is the, he is like the farmer who came up out of his cyclone cellar to find his home ruined. To his wife, he remarked, "Don't say anything the matter here, Ma. Ain't it grand the wind stopped blowing?" And I know for me, like, I definitely had some of those old beliefs that I hadn't caused trouble when it's so obvious that I have, that I had. And then finally, their spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. Unless one's family expresses a desire to live upon spiritual principles, we think we ought not to urge them. Why? Because that's all of this is on us. So as I said, last week, was it? Yeah. That's actually not why. Just my scorecards reading 0 wasn't really enough for me. It took that major surrender, the giving up, the turning to some other source. And in my experience with doing the steps, finding, discerning what were those old ideas? What were those, well, not principles, but what were those beliefs that I was operating on? And I think I referenced that earlier, that this guy like Thomas Keating, who talks about programs for happiness. You know, what was my program for happiness? What was my what was the system I was working in that I was using? And that's where like the fourth step comes in. So I'm doing this inventory and I'm finding all these things and I begin to detect some patterns. What is it? What is this bulwark? What is this persona through which I'm going to get what I need to get by? Like, what is my operating system, you know? And whatever that operating system is, ultimately will fail because it's human-based. Mm-hmm. And it's based on my limited beliefs. And all those, you know, all the things that I can't see are going to be a problem. And mostly because all you guys have different thoughts and ideas, ultimately they're going to conflict with mine somehow. I'm not going to get what I want from everybody. I'm not. And that's going to make me so uncomfortable. My only way around it is to drink. So how am I going to switch that around? And that's, you know, we start that with the four step. Like, I'm looking at all the stuff I did. And then doing it in my out loud voice with another human. That's when I start to see, that's when I started to see some of the patterns. And if I were to reference Father Keating, like, he talks, one of the programs for happiness is esteem and approval or something, right? Like, mm-hmm. Esteem. I'm all about people pleasing. I'm all about the parade when I do something nice, you know? And it's not, you know, it's tricky because it can look nice. It can look like I do nice things for people. But if you don't thank me, or if you're not impressed with how awesome I am, you know, that ain't happening for me. And it wasn't until I could really get into my motives that I was in that completely self-centered place, not the God-centered place of one of constant giving, that, you know, that was a problem. And then, like, in the eighth and ninth step, you know, I see that in practice. And I realized these were the things I had to make amends for. And one of my hardest amends, from my experience of amends was the ones that I thought were going to be kind of like, oh, this person's going to be really understanding and da-da-da-da, and that person's going to reject it outright. It was like almost always not the way it worked. Mm-hmm. And so in the spirit of thinking, believing that I hadn't hurt anybody else with my alcoholism or just not enough people who really, you know, I need to worry about, one of them was my younger brother. And when I made my amends with him, he'd got me into that first rehab that I just drank the first day I left. Like, he'd come out to California, he'd done all these nice things for me, and I just thought I'd get the goddamn parade again, excuse my French, but I thought he'd just be so happy I was sober. And but I knew I'd put him through some pain, and I put that out there, and, you know, I did all this. I put myself in that place where, like, you know, I did the amends from the place of staying open. You know, it was really hard, but just staying open because I wanted to be open to whatever feedback, whatever was going to come back, which was just super uncomfortable and not what I was used to. And I said, I knew that I had caused him a lot of pain and that he was probably afraid. He was like, well, no, that. He said, no, I had accepted that you were going to die. You know, it blew my mind. Like, what must that have been like? You know? Hmm. So these are the things that, you know, I started to learn as I started to open my eyes and give up a little bit. But I can tell you, again, Jim referenced the bungee cord, how we can be pulled out. Like, I can go back. Sure. Like, I like this new house with its foundation of God, but I can also go back to the old crappy one, you know, that's falling apart, you know. I can easily go back to those old thoughts and ideas. Those are wired. I have a lot more practice with those old ideas than I do with these new God-centered ones. You know, the old ideas are bright and shiny sometimes, you know. They're really appealing. And I can tell you, I was sharing this a few weeks ago, I was like, can tell you that what I know when I'm not in a God-centered place, when I'm looking for esteem, when I'm fearing your disapproval, when my perfectionism rears its head, and I can think back as far as about 2 hours ago when I was in that place with my job and thinking, oh, you know, I made a mistake, I'm going to get disapproval. All of that sort of anxiety-producing place, the places that I can be if I'm not God-centered. So with the steps, at least, you know, my eyes are open enough to see, right? But it's the work is to choose differently. And that's really uncomfortable and really hard. And since I've been sober, as advertised, 15 years, you know, that was amazing, and it is amazing that I don't want to drink anymore. But other behaviors start to show up, you know? My codependency, my stuff with eating or not eating, you know? I start to use those things to manage my uncomfortability. And, you know, I'd say I have all of the stuff, all of the addictive things. I'm just lucky I never got addicted to smoking, you know. But I will reach to that thing that I can control to manage my discomfort, and that is this continual surrender, and it's not fun. Like, some things are kind of easy. Like, I can, if I'm gonna get the cash and prizes, you know, yeah, like, I'll do that thing. I'll come from a God-centered place if it's gonna, you know, if it's gonna feel good. But what about when it doesn't feel good? Which is kind of a lot of the time, you know? Yeah. And reaching out to others, you know. I just always, if once my eyes have been opened, and they have been, like, how could they not be? It's really challenging to, when you always know the truth. But that's kind of where we're at. You know what I mean? It's kind of where we're at. Like, nothing else really works. I mean, because everything else is limited, and everything else is my old thoughts and ideas, and it is so easy to tell. I can feel it. I can feel when I'm in that selfish place, you know, including working with another alcoholic. Like, why? Okay, this other person, you know, this other individual is really struggling, right? So my motives for reaching out, as somebody who's a people pleaser, it's tricky. What is my motive? My motive is to give this program, for which I am grateful and that I did nothing to create, to pass that message. That's it. That's all I can do. I can't do anything else. And that's where we benefit. We don't benefit because the other person gets sober and we can feel amazing. You know, I mean, that's great to see, right? But that's not us. We didn't do anything, right? And I also can't do it because it makes me feel better because, like, that poor guy, like, he's still drinking and I'm not, and I'm amazing, you know? So there's so many tricks that our minds can do. And that's why I love, like, checking out all these different sources. They might say the same thing, but I need it all. Like, I need to hear it from all directions because I'm an idiot. Like, and I will go back to the house that needs the seismic retrofit because I know that house. You know what I mean? Yeah. So that's really all I have. I'll pass it over.
Okay, honey.
Still Jim, still an alcoholic.
Hi, John.
I love the microphone.
Yeah.
I think I really do. Yeah.
Look out.
There's always, you know, that was always another career. I could, you know, go to Nashville or something. Yeah, so I have a lot of thoughts about, like, I love the coming home thing. I love the way that sounds. When I think of that, the first thing that comes to my mind is when I was at rehab in Pennsylvania in 2003, and we used to go on Sundays, they would have a mass. And I mentioned this last week. They would have a mass, and there was a children's group across the street from the main rehab. And so all the kids would come over to Mass, and their parents would be there. And Father Bill, the priest, would have certain kids come up, and then they would invite their parents to come up. And these kids would make amends to their parents. These were, you know, 14, 15, 16-year-old heroin addicts that had put their parents through hell and, you know, worried them to death. And that was kind of, you know, and I showed up at rehab after 20 years of pills, you know, so I was pretty frozen out. You know, I wasn't feeling a lot of stuff when I got there. And so when I was watching this process, I started to get really emotional. I mean, the kids making amends to their parents was so amazing. And I wasn't aware of how, like, dead I was. I had no idea at the time. You know, I showed up at rehab probably in better shape than anybody else that was there, you know, because I was on pills. You know, I was medicated. I was like, what's, you know, guys are coming in on walkers, you know, getting dragged in, dropped off. And I was feeling, you know, pretty good. But this was, you know, a couple weeks in when I got off the pills. I was in pretty rough shape. And seeing this process with the kids and their parents was kind of a heart opening. Or it was something, it was like me coming, it was coming home in a sense that I was, because I had like lost any sense of who I was or what I was. I couldn't feel anything. I didn't know I couldn't feel anything. I had completely obliterated all reality of any consequence. You know what I mean? And so that initial awakening is still with me today. I mean, that changed me completely. I was kind of a bit of a wise guy. You know, I knew everything. You know, when I was growing up, and my dad used to, you know, I drove my dad nuts with my shenanigans. You know, I had a lot of just natural gifts, and I could do a lot of things, and I took credit for all that, because, I mean, who else am I going to give credit for that? I mean, it's all me. You know what I mean? I didn't know there was anything, you know, I didn't know there was a source of energy that was coming from somewhere other than me. I thought it was coming from me. I thought I was God, although I didn't consciously think that. Do you know what I mean? I was just going along on my way. Coming out of rehab, I was a different individual. Now I was a very compromised individual. I was not very functional when I left there. I mean, to say I was in bad shape would be to put it mildly, but the coming home piece that happened when I was at rehab was also majorly impactful. You know what I mean? And so I came out of there with no desire to drink at all. I was like, I don't know what that's about, but, you know, and I don't feel good, and I don't know how I'm going to get through this, but I didn't have any, I wasn't struggling with using or drinking or anything. My children, so I got divorced when my kids were 2 and 4, and I was in active addiction. So when I got out of rehab, that was in 2003, and I got divorced in 96. And so there was all kinds of damage there. And my kids were still very young. They were 9 and 11 when I got out of rehab. And so my life at that time was going to meetings, you know, surviving from one day to the next. Literally, I'd be at a meeting and I'd say, see you guys in the morning. And I would be like, thank God I can see them in the morning. You know what I mean? Because the thought of doing anything much other than that was just too much. So it was, at that time, so it was my life in the rooms every day. You know, it would go every day, same meeting. And then it was my kids. And so I had no idea that I was completely disconnected from everyone at that time when I got sober. And even though I was physically in their lives, it was explained to me by this psychiatrist/neuroscientist, Dan Siegel. He explained that when your cerebral cortex is offline, which it is if you're on pills for 20 years, right? So you can be with your children physically, but when that's blocked off by a medication, the heart signals that we now know from neuroscience that transfer back and forth from individual to individual, especially parent to child, that's not happening. You know? And it's not like I'm going to get arrested because that's not happening. But there's going to be a consequence in your connection with your children if there's been a long period of time, their early formative years, when that connection wasn't coming from you. Even though you were picking them up every week, giving them a bath and dressing them and feeding them dinner and all that stuff. That was probably the most... Yeah, like to say that I couldn't get my head around like what the reality was at that point was, I just remember, you know, and again, I wasn't struggling with wanting to use or drink or anything, so I was like, okay, well, so I remember there was a situation where my kids were over for the weekend or whatever for their visitation, and I was so like vibrating, and my kids could feel it, and they were so uncomfortable that my son Harry goes, "Dad, I think I have to leave." I was like, "Oh my God!" You know, that to me was like, this recovery is not working. Yeah, this is definitely not working. You know what I mean? So that's the kind of crap that I was going through in my coming home process. And what I don't want to leave out is the fact that through all of this, that coming home peace, that really wonderful kind of warmth was there throughout this whole process. Do you know what I mean? Otherwise, it wouldn't have been doable. There'd just be no way you could have pain and suffering and nothing to hold on to. You know what I mean? That wouldn't be doable, I don't think. So I was mentioning this morning with Stefan and the meeting that I've been going to most of my recovery for 18 years now. It's not a big book meeting. It's not a meeting where you even necessarily bump into the steps. But it is a group of alcoholics that are getting together for a common purpose. And it's a very powerful group. I can't think of a more powerful group. I've been to many. I went on a search for a better group. Had about 5 or 6 years sober because, you know, when I found out that they weren't doing the steps and they weren't doing this and it was just a bunch of people talking about stuff, I knew I needed to go somewhere else and get the real program. You know what I mean? Which I did, you know. Got a couple of gurus, a couple of guys that could take me through the steps. And Julia tried to point out to me that my guru was inside of me. And I was like, that's not true. You know, that's definitely not true. You know, because I had a couple of really good guys. You know, Adrian, this guy that we love. You guys know Adrian from Ireland. He's amazing. You know, and I was like, I listened to him at this. He sat in for Barefoot Bill. One weekend, and told his story, and I was mesmerized. And I went up to him afterwards. I'm like, dude, you know. You're going to save me.
You're going to save me.
I went through the steps with him, and it was amazing. You know, it was really powerful. But after all that, you know, I worked with Pete M. at one point, Pete Marinelli, you know, another really amazing guy in AA. But at the end of the day, I went back to that room, to that group, and that's my home. You know, that's my home group. And that's where I landed when I was in the most vulnerable, tender place you could possibly be. And so that process, reconnecting with my children and dealing with the reality of what was happening on a day-to-day, month-to-month, year-to-year basis, really, really, really difficult. because there was such a lack of connection. And in the early days, I didn't know why that was. You know what I mean? I didn't understand that those connections were not happening. Those heart connections. I didn't get that. You know what I mean? What do I know? You know? I drink and take pills to block everything out. That's what I'm good at. You know what I mean? I didn't know the workings of recovery and how this thing works. So ultimately, that was and still is, in a lot of ways, a work in progress. You know what I mean? That reality is my reality. You know what I mean? What I love about my story, the most I love about it, is that it's mine. You know what I mean? It's no one else's. Nobody can take that from me. And I don't know if there's anything other than Julia and my children that I cherish more than my recovery. Because it's brought me back to life. And it's done things for me and taken me to me stumbling upon Sermon on the Mount and Emmett Fox and being like over the moon about it was not who I was 20 years ago. I was good time Charlie. I was like, let's, you know, what's going on? Where are we going tonight? You know, and that was it. There was no internal awareness of anything. You know what I mean? So, running short on time. I have 1 minute to wrap this up. So anyway, I mean, I could go on for days about coming home. And Julia, she touched on the meat and potatoes of the steps. And I've been through the steps now, I would say, maybe 4 or 5 times. One of the things I have to share, because I love this, about my experience with the steps. 4th and 5th step, I'd heard, you know, that, you know, the heavens opened and the band played and all that. It never happened for me. I just never got that experience. I never had that experience at all. But in my 8th and 9th steps,
yeah,
that's where the gold is. Same. At least for me, that's where the gold is.
Yeah.
I did my amends with my daughter Lucy and my son Harry and my ex-wife Kim. And one thing I wanted to just jump back to, I had asked Harry once, my son, we were playing golf and having dinner afterwards once, and during the course of my recovery, it's been very challenging up until the last 3 or 4 years when I've gotten much calmer. The 20 years of pills, it's like 18 years sober now, so I'm kind of balancing that out a little bit. But I asked my son Harry, I said, because sometimes I would think that I wasn't, you know, that it was a bad idea that I ever got sober. You know what I mean? Because this was too painful. This just was a bad idea. I said, Harry, do you think it was a good idea that I got sober? And he goes, absolutely.
Coming from Harry, that's a big.
And Harry, my son doesn't have. He's not a man of a lot of words. Would that be fair? You know what I mean? And I was like, awesome. That's all I needed to hear. Yeah. That's all I needed to hear. Yeah. I'm good enough. I'm another 20 years. I'm good. Yeah. I'm good. And then I'll check in with you again. But yeah, my amends with Harry, Lucy, my ex-wife, and I think a powerful amends with Julia as well, because Julia, I've been with Julia since 2009, and I'm going to say, when do you think I was better than I was then? Maybe 2016?
Yeah, get in there.
Okay, so there was a lot of years in there where this woman was holding me in her arms, literally, when I know I wouldn't have, I don't think I could have done that. You know what I mean? I don't think I could have given that same, because I would have been too stressed out. but yeah, I made an amends to Julia about just, you know, some of the carrying on and the nonsense, you know, I remember coming down in the mornings and just being a bull, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't sleep, and, you know, all that, you know, more damage, you know, more damage in sobriety. And so, again, I could go on forever, but I'm going to wrap it up because we want to take some questions or comments or whatever. So that's all we have.
Thank you.